Welcome to Bring on the Mess, a show where we have real conversations about how to embrace life's messiness and how we find ways to show up and uncover our true selves. I'm Beth Ann Dorman, the CEO at For All Seasons.
And I'm Lisa Lee, the Chief Clinical Officer here at For All Seasons.
We are so glad to be with you today. And, you know, Lisa, the last time that we put the podcast out, it was on a topic that was maybe a little bit difficult for people to listen to and or really thought-provoking. And it was on sexual assault, because this is April and it's Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And being the Mental Health and Rape Crisis Center, we really have a desire, an obligation, and I think really it's our responsibility to be talking about some of these really hard topics. But we sat in the podcast last week and then afterwards and said, we've got more to talk about. And so as we think about Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we shared with you a little bit about my why and working with sexual assault, how it shows up sometimes in your clinical sessions. So, you know, the disclaimer is really important in this episode, where we say to you all, this is going to potentially bring up some hard stuff, and we want to make sure that we put that out prior to us getting started with the podcast. But it occurred to us after our recording that one of the things that we sometimes get in conversation about at the Rape Crisis Center is this whole idea of what is truth and what is fact as right. It applies to sexual assault. And sometimes truth and fact look really different, but what we think we know is different than what is actually happening. And I think that can be said in all areas of life.
And it's interesting because I've been doing clinical work for about 26 years, and with young kids, with older adults, and when it comes to issues of sexual assault, there's still a little bit of surprise in me when I say, oh, you know, something like, or that wasn't your fault, or, you know, did you know that this was a sexual assault, that people are sort of confused by that. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a really important way today that we can communicate to people some myths and facts about what sexual assault is and the experiences, mm-hmm. so that people can maybe begin to, if anything, chip away at some of those old beliefs that maybe they hold around sexual assault.
Yeah. And I think it's also really important for us to sort of start off by talking about how these myths and facts sometimes get confusing for people. And so thinking through things like, where do the myths and facts come from?
Right, right.
Through media, through social media, through someone's interaction, or perhaps we take one situation that is a single experience and then it becomes truth.
Right. You know, in my experience also, like generational mm-hmm. beliefs sometimes get imposed on people. And so if my mother or father believed this, or the generations before, mm-hmm. it sometimes moves forward that this must be a truth. So yeah, social media, you know, generational maybe experiences and what the society is telling us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are the things that as we sort of move through, we have about, you know, 7 or 8 different myths and facts that we want to just sort of talk through that really have become the kind of conversation pieces where we can be a part of the solution to ending sexual violence. And I think it's important when we talk through all of these myths and facts that we're going to be talking about sexual assault, domestic violence, child sexual abuse, but some of these things could cross over into other areas as well. And so knowing that this may apply to family members, this may apply to victims, this may apply to what we've read in the media or how we perceive a situation in the media. And so just sort of like thinking through that piece of it while we talk through some of these myths and facts.
So let's start with the first one, the myth. A person cannot sexually assault their partner or spouse.
And so that's a really, really interesting piece. We live in the state of Maryland, and I will tell you that in addition to the work that I do here at For All Seasons, I also chair the board of directors for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And we are really proud in the state of Maryland to say now that marriage is not a defense in sexual assault. But until 2023, in fact, there was a law that supported that if you were married, it could not be considered a sexual assault. And so I want to make it really clear that for this particular myth in the state of Maryland, it's what we're talking about. However, I also want to be really clear that nearly 1 in 10 women have experienced rape by an intimate partner in their lifetime. And so we know that intimate partner violence happens. We know that there are some situations where a spouse has raped another spouse. And again, in the state of Maryland now, we're really glad to be able to say that that is an offense that can be taken to court and can be seen through. But that does happen. You know, there may be people that are married. There may be people that are separated. There may be inter-partner relationships. This is not something that just because you're married, anyone has the right to do whatever they want to you.
And I think two things I think about. I wonder if that number is underreported a little bit, the 1 in 10.
Sure.
And so that's something to consider. And then the thing that I think about is what we talked a little bit about, even on the last podcast, I believe, about consent and mm-hmm. how consent matters. Mm-hmm. And the part that I'm thinking, did we talk about it? But I'm pretty sure we did. The one video that you talked about, the tea video.
Oh, yeah, the tea video.
And so if you didn't hear the other podcast, there was this, Beth Ann had showed me this video, which I guess has been around for a long while. Mm-hmm. And it's about consent. And so if you Google, is it like tea and consent?
Yeah, if you Google a cup of tea and consent, it'll show you this video. But the premise of it is that just because somebody asks you if you'd like a cup of tea, if you say no in a situation where someone says, hey, would you like a cup of tea, you're not going to then force them to drink a cup of tea. Same thing applies with sexual assault. If someone says, do you want to have sex, or someone goes to try to have sex and you say no, there should never be a situation where you are then forced to have sex.
Right. Even if you are married.
Correct. Even if you are married. And, you know, you brought up a really good point too, Lisa, about the underreporting, because we know that when we look at numbers of sexual assault reporting, we know that only 1 in 4 people come forward and report. And so that means that 2, 3, and 4 are not reporting. And it's a really important thing for us to know about. And there's all different reasons why people do and do not report. And one of the myths around it is that, well, it must have not happened because it wasn't reported. Or if someone doesn't report a sexual assault right away, well, they're lying and they're making up a story. And I think that the piece that's important for folks to know is not only is sexual assault dramatically underreported, it is also important for us to talk about the fact that rapes are, you know, people sometimes when we look at the media, there may be a high profile rape case where a victim is found to have been lying. Mm-hmm. And I specifically remember there was a sexual assault case that happened involving a college in the South, the lacrosse team, and the victim ended up being found not to have been telling the truth. So people see that one story, and largely in like what you saw in comments and social media, the perception is, see, the rape victims are not telling the truth. When the reality is, the number of falsely reported rapes is no different than the number of falsely reported robberies. Mm. And that's a really important piece, because it's less than 8% of robberies are falsely reported. So me coming into a station and saying, I was just robbed in the middle of the street, the probability of me going in and reporting a false rape is the same probability as someone going in and reporting a false robbery. And that becomes really important, because when we think about the questions that are asked of victims who have been robbed, sometimes the questions that are asked of sexual assault victims who there may be a perception that someone's not telling the truth. I did this great training when I was up in the state of New York, and it was working with law enforcement and talking with law enforcement about what are the questions you're asking a rape victim. Mm-hmm. Do they sit in along the same lines as something that you would be asking to a robber? You want to know the details. What was that person doing? Can you tell me what the person looked like, who, you know, can you describe the person? Can you tell me what was in your wallet? Versus sometimes in investigations, it might be more about the victim of like, what were you doing? Right. Where were you? How much did you have to drink? What were you wearing? Those are some of the questions that we may hear about as we're talking about a sexual assault reporting versus a robbery reporting.
So it's interesting when I hear you say that there could be a perception or a survivor's experience of, you know, maybe it was my fault. Mm-hmm. If there's like, what were you wearing? Were you drinking? And I would imagine that the intention is not to do that. I don't know. I mean, I try to live pretty generously in life about what people are doing. But what I appreciate about what you said is there's an education component mm-hmm. that goes along with how are we interviewing our right. survivors of sexual assault. And there could be this perception potentially that, hey, you know, they're asking me, what was I wearing? What was I drinking? And mm-hmm. that could come across as maybe that there was something that I did to contribute to the sexual assault.
Absolutely. And in all of that, what we know is that the more that we can have conversations like what we're having today, mm-hmm. the more that we can help to bring that education. Because I think 100% you are correct. No one goes into any situation like that trying to nail down and say, it's your fault. But right. sometimes the questions that are asked or the perceptions that are brought to the table may lead someone to feel that way.
And you know what, before we go, I want to go back to something you said about there was something about another myth in what you had said. But before we do that, I guess what I would say is for anybody asking, whether it's a friend, a colleague, a family member who's been sexually assaulted, that there could be this perception in the questions. And mm-hmm. so it doesn't have to be just law enforcement. It's a little bit about how we can maybe be there to support folks. And so mm-hmm. just want to throw that little nugget in there that if somebody was sexually assaulted and coming to you, that it's not your job to figure out what happened or didn't happen. It's just to be there to support that person in that moment at that time. And then the rest of the law enforcement, they can go from there. But I would say to be there to support that person is a really important aspect.
I am so appreciative that you brought that up. So here would be the myth in that. My job as someone who has heard that you have been sexually assaulted is to take control and handle the situation and help you to make all of the decisions. That would be the myth.
Right.
The fact is, if you've come to me and said I've been sexually assaulted, the person who is on the receiving end of that is to be there to support, because the reality of when someone has been sexually assaulted, and the fact is they have lost control, not by choice. So control has been taken from them through someone else. It was not within their control what happened to them. And so the fact is that what sexual assault victims need in that moment is to have control placed back with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the beauty of you can come to the rape crisis centers. And this is true for rape crisis centers across the country. You know, we're talking about Maryland, but at any rape crisis center, the job of the rape crisis center is not to tell you what to do. The fact is that the jobs of the Rape Crisis Center are to help guide you and provide you options. Now, when I say that, we certainly are talking about of age victims, men and women who are of age that would not be going through the Department of Social Services and Child Advocacy Centers. When it's children, the person who is the guardian or the parent and Department of Social Services would work together. But there is definitely a choice for adult victims in how they move. So I remember working with a young student at one of the colleges that I worked at who had been assaulted, and it was a pretty serious assault. And her father came into my office and he was fuming, and he said, "This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do." And I said to him, "Sir, the last thing that your daughter needs right now is for you to be like the Jolly Green Giant and come in and take the situation over. What she needs is she needs your support, and she needs to be able to make some decisions and have the control to be able to do that."
So let me reiterate. Okay, so the first myth we talk about is a person cannot sexually assault their partner or spouse. We said that that's not true, that there's actually laws mm-hmm. now in the state of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Then we talked about all sexual assault victims, that sexual assault victims might be lying. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about law enforcement and how they might interview, which led us into if the myth of, like, I have to go in, which mm-hmm. was a really good example of how you just brought that father in.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is he wants to protect his
child.
Of course. But he's going in and he's saying, this is what we need to do. Whereas what we're saying is you don't have to fix it.
Right.
Just be there, because we want to give back some control to mm-hmm. the sexual assault survivor.
Yeah.
Got it.
So one of the things that we also know, we mentioned it very briefly, but the myth that someone who is wearing revealing clothing or behaving provocatively or drinking a lot means that the victim was, quote unquote, asking for it. And the fact is that perpetrators select victims And the behavior or clothing choices doesn't mean that anyone's consenting to sexual activity. You know, perpetrators look for vulnerable. Mm-hmm. They look for opportunity. I think it's really important to loop into this myth that, you know, I remember growing up when it was like the Lifetime movies would be on when I got home from school. And it was like, watch out for the boogeyman jumping out of the bushes. Well, the fact is that that's not most times when we are looking at sexual assault cases. 90% of victims of sexual assault know their perpetrator. And so what someone's wearing, what they are engaged in terms of, you know, somebody could be at a dance party and drinking, that does not then give the green light for someone to, without consent, move in a direction, whether it be rape, sexual assault, sexual harassment. That has nothing to do with someone's body being violated.
So there's this theme of consent that continues to come up over and over. And one of the things that I'd love to talk a little bit about is the myth of, if I didn't say anything, mm-hmm. or if my body was aroused during the sexual assault, mm-hmm. that must be
right.
I wanted it or I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm.
So that's a really important piece for us to talk through, because there certainly is going to be situations where your body is going to freeze. And, you know, that whole fight, flight, or freeze, there are different ways that our bodies respond to trauma. And so where we may see in the movies or on television where someone's like flailing and fighting and screaming no,
right?
So there's one aspect. There's also the aspect of your entire body shuts down. Your brain is protecting you and your body, and there may be no words spoken at all. And it may be something where it's like an outer body experience for the victim. And then there may be a mix of in between. You may have someone who has said no enough and finally just realizes that to be able to protect themselves and get through the situation, that they're just going to stop fighting. So all of those things do not equal. Like if we had them on a flowchart, none of those responses equal, please do something to me that I've asked you not to do.
And it's really important that the body does respond. And so thank you so much for bringing that in. And when you were talking about the person sort of going away or not having an out of body of experience, just for folks to know, that's called dissociation. Mm-hmm. And so that's a strategy, a very protective strategy that people do in order to manage a really incredibly highly stressful situation. Mm-hmm. And for kids, you know, if kids are sexually assaulted, just think about this. They don't have the ability as well to fight off, defend. They might be threatened. Their family might be threatened. And this can certainly happen to adults as well. So I don't want to say it's exclusive to kids. But, you know, I do work with the kid population as well. And that's a really hard thing. I didn't do anything. Well, of course you didn't do anything. You're just a child. Or if this is an adult, of course you didn't do anything. The safest thing for you in that moment was most likely to do nothing.
Correct. And I think then the other piece that you brought up that's really important for us to review is when someone is noticing that their body is feeling arousal. We know that we don't always have control over how our body responds. And arousal is not something that equals, please do this to me, this is consent. Arousal is typically something that is out of our control. And so particularly when it comes to oral sex, there are certainly our young children and populations and adults where there may not be the ability for us to process. Like, you can't say to your body, like, don't get aroused.
Right.
That's just not possible.
Right.
And so what's really important for us to clarify today is that when your body is responding in a way where arousal is present, it does not mean that you were giving permission.
Correct. And I'll just add to what you said, which is our bodies are also meant to feel good. Mm-hmm. And so when you say, like, we can't just shut it off, our bodies are meant to feel good. And there's a lot of work that I end up doing with adults typically after. And so I would say that if you are you know, somebody who is a sexual assault survivor and struggling in this area of intimacy, please go connect with somebody clinician-wise to be able to work through, because this is a really big area that I have found in my practice that people really do struggle with, which is sort of now figuring out, how do I have a safe, intimate relationship with a partner?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, for sure. So as we come to the close of podcast today, we hope that it has been informative for you and also given us some talking points. I think the other, as we wrap up, the other thing that's really important is that when we talk about rape and sexual assault, that we're doing it in a way where we can have a safe conversation, that we're doing it in a way where if we've been triggered, we, you know, it's really important for us to put out to all of you that if something in today's podcast has triggered you, or if you're feeling like you need to talk to someone, there are hotlines that are present. They're 24-hour hotlines. We ourselves at the agency have a 24-hour hotline, which is 410-829-6143. There's also RAIN, which is the rape organization, and it has the National Sexual Assault Hotline, which is 800-656-HOPE. And so just making sure that we, again, acknowledge that this is not a topic that everyone is comfortable talking about, and it may be difficult to sit afterwards, and you may have questions, you may have things that have come up, but what we really want folks to know is that resources are available.
And the last little thing that I'll leave for any sexual assault survivor listening is, our hope is that maybe you will take a nugget or have an experience that you say to yourself, huh, maybe something different, if you're struggling with any of the things, any of the myths that, you know, we had brought up. Maybe if you hear some of the facts, maybe there is something that could have shifted just a teeny bit for you today.
Absolutely. We'll be with you again in another couple weeks. Hope that you have a great week, and thanks for listening.